In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is D&D plus economics.
Consistent tone, consistent feel, fun ride.
The characters are actually organic and interesting, so good writer. It's taken a major turn of like, they are going the terrorist route. Fantasy terrorism. We're going to leave that there.
Welcome back to another Shooter Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
This is a spoiler-free and spoiler-full review for the book Orkonomics, and we're going to give spoiler-free for the first 10-15 minutes, as we always do, but this is a special spoiler-free that we have today because mini announcement. We did this on social media if you follow us there, but Rich and I, we are now judges for the SBFBO Contest of Champions. What that means is the SBFBO is the self-published fantasy blog-off that is hosted and organized by author Mark Lawrence. And he invited us to be one of the 10 judges who looks through the past 10 years of this competition, the SBFBO, this blog off with self-published fantasy. And the champions of those prior 10 years are now being put against each other to see what is the best of the best self-published fantasy books of this contest history.
We have some strong contenders.
We do.
I think today's book. Now, also, if you think, hey, this book looks familiar on this channel, not too long ago, we did a video on a spoiler-free pitch of this book where I read it and pitched it to Austin and you guys that should you read the book and what it's all about. If you're interested in maybe a longer spoiler-free pitch for that, for this novel, go ahead and check that video out.
And you did a mighty fine job. I think everything that you set my expectations for was met perfectly.
Wonderful. I did the correct job then.
You prepared me for each and every... I went, yeah, Rich told me this would happen.
Wonderful.
Not that you spoiled it, but you gave me the proper emotional expectations.
Is that maybe too much? Did I do too good of a job then?
You should have underplayed it.
I gave you no surprises where you go like, yes, Rich did not tell me that plot beat would happen, but he gave me the emotional beats that, like, I knew what I should feel.
You told me how to feel, and I felt that way. No, but to be honest, there was moments that surprised me where I had more fun than I thought I would.
That is something I couldn't get into in the actual spoiler-free.
Well, this is spoiler-free here.
So, I couldn't get into the previous video. But yeah, I think there's a lot of surprising elements in this novel, which my expectations were succeeded when I first read this novel.
This novel is by J. Zachary Pike. It is a trilogy of books, all are out. It's called The Dark Prophet Saga. This is book one of The Dark Prophet Saga. This was put into the 2018 SPFBO competition. It was written before that, but that was the year that it won. And this, and any other info you have about it, that's just a generic stuff. Anything you want to add?
That's all you need.
Okay. And so that's a generic info behind Orkonomics. And it won the competition that year by large margin. It had an 8.65 out of 10 average amongst the 10 amongst the 10 critics that were reviewing the book, which is very hard to get when you're averaging 10 scores and get that. It's like IMDb. Yeah. Think about it that way, where you see IMDb scores. You never see a movie above 9.2. Most are in the 8s because of just how the mean works with those rating sites. So very high acclaim. Won the competition. To give a spoiler-free pitch for this book, how would you grab people in like you did? You did such a good job in the other one, Rich. How would you grab them again?
Sure.
Can you strike? Can lightning strike twice?
I'll do it again.
Okay.
All right. So overall, by the just title, Orkonomics, you instantly kind of know, hey, fantasy, but also about economics. Is this, and by the Dark Prophet saga, is this a critique of capitalism with fantasy elements? Yes, but also better than your expectation. I am one of those people, like, I've read the stories, like, oh, great, the big villain is big evil corporation again. Oh, what a shocker. How fresh, how new. And I'm no big company simp. I like my capitalism, but I have my gripes. So, point being, all spread aside, I think the nuance that this book goes into is far more tasteful and fun than just a generic anti-capitalism message. It actually specifically goes into the 2008 market crash in the United States. That's the parody. So if you like The Big Short and you like D&D, this is the book for you. It's like exactly for you. On top of that, I did not expect to actually really like the characters as much as I did. At a certain level, I was thinking, okay, these characters are caricatures, to give an example, but they developed into something more. And so I found the book with a lot of heart, an interesting message, fun representation, and overall a damn good time.
That's very well said, because I think almost exactly as you do, where the characters are archetypes. You'll go, oh, it's the premise of the book is they're going on this fetch quest. You find this out right away. It's a fetch quest with your archetypal, your bard, your ranger, your mages, your disgruntled protagonist who has a past. And you have all these archetypes, but they are, you'll be attached more to their personality. They don't have depth to them. They have personalities.
With some exception, and definitely ones that you go, oh, I see that there is depth there. Mm. We just haven't gone into it yet.
It's a trilogy.
Some more than over. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was something that thoroughly surprised me.
Yes.
That interested me in reading on.
So you got that obvious fellowship trope. And I would say other similar books, if you like these, if you like Kings of the Wild by Nicholas Eames, actually on the cover of the book, I don't know if it's on this one, but Nicholas Eames says it's one of his favorite trilogies. He loves it. And Kings of the Wild is that D&D style, except you mix D&D plus rock and roll.
This is D&D plus economics, which personally is more up my alley. So
there you go. Nerd. Okay, then you have Dungeon Crawler Carl. I would say if you like Dungeon Crawler Carl, this could also be up your alley as well. As far as that, you get those game vibes to it, because this has a very cool gamey feel to it. Not as in meat, but yeah.
Well, actually, even in the meat, like the general message of Dungeon Crawler Carl, like your big emotional, like, theme throughout the story is, like, you know, man against the big corporate machine.
Yeah.
Well, you're getting a little bit of that in this book, too.
Yes. And I would say, lastly, you hear this out there. People have compared Orkonomics to Terry Pratchett Discworld-esque. I wouldn't say that, personally.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
You wouldn't either? Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I see why, because it's satire. It's funny. It's very different, though. It's...
This is a different kind of satire. Terry Pratchett is the far more, like, mainly more subtle wittiness of, like, honestly, just your standard British humor. I think the humor in Orkonomics is a bit more on the nose, still funny, but different. And different humor.
True, and it's even not as on the nose as, I think, like, Kings of the Wild that we just said is a little bit more on the nose than this. It's closer to Kings of the Wild, though, than it is to Terry Pratchett stuff.
Yeah.
And so obviously Nicholas Eames loves it. And we had Nicholas Eames on for an episode that was cool about what do authors owe readers? What do readers owe authors? And very fun, cool guy. And I guess we got to get to our spoiler-free rating.
Sure.
What is your, actually, I know your rating, I think. because you've told me. Well, what is it?
I've also readjusted and thought about this novel, especially prepping for the review.
Mm-hmm.
So currently my review is a 3.5 out of 5.
Good.
Book good.
Book
good book.
Good. No, I struggled with my rating here.
Yeah.
I didn't know whether to go 2.25 higher or stick where I landed. This mm-hmm. could adjust by the end of this episode, so you'll convince me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going lower than this, though. 4 stars. Great.
Fantastic.
It's either going there 4 or 4.25. As we talk more, I'll see if it goes a little higher. But 4 stars, great book. Recommend for everybody that we just recommended to, that if you're in that category of reader. This also has more broad appeal. I think it's approachable. It's not Shadow of the Torture. It's not Dead House Gates. There's a lot of books recently we read I can't recommend to your average reader. I like that. When you read a book and you go, oh, I can talk about this or maybe recommend this to one of our friends. Good. That's awesome.
True.
That's way more approachable.
I will say I was struggling with the reason why I didn't quite give it the... So I was a little higher and I dropped a little lower.
I thought you had higher in the past.
I was higher. The reason why I didn't is... I couldn't quite give it the 4 of great is my love of the ending and then the rest of the book. Like we'll get into the details of
okay.
it, but I think one part of the novel is much better than the other. And even though there's nothing particularly bad about it. Anyway, if we're beating around the bush too much,
I had consistent fun. We're sorry. This is still spoiler free, so we have to beat around the bush until we can get into it. Last thing. Okay, two more things. The most important thing at the end here of the spoiler free section. But second to last thing is, what was your best category, worst categories? And then we'll show our total scores down below so they can see.
Well, I have a tie from the best category being characters and emotional impact.
You're correct. I have a tie for characters and emotional impact.
So that is a 3.75 for me.
Okay.
Really good.
I have them both at 4.25s. Really great. Yeah. And then I would say the worst, and none of these are bad categories. I would say this book's not going for as much. My lowest is thought-provoking, but it's not bad thought-provoking. It is mm-hmm. good, but it was my lowest of the six.
Sure. I actually had that. That wasn't my lowest. My lowest for me was World Building in Prose at just a 3.25, which is, above average.
Still, Oh, here's our total scores if you want to see down below, right on the screen there. Ding, ding, ding. We'll obviously then get into all of them. But last thing is this, Rich. Every SBFBO that we read now, we have to place it because we have to send to Mark Lawrence after this for the competition.
Yep.
And so far, we've read 2 SBFBOs. With this competition, there's 10 books. This is the second one we've read. The first one, Sword of Kaigan. We've had videos on that being a masterpiece. Yada yada. So it's no surprise. I think we'll agree. Sword of Kaigan 1, Orconomics 2.
Currently, as it is,
no debate. But how we'll figure this out in the future is okay. Next book that we read, I'm guessing. So let's say the third SBFBO we'll do. Mm-hmm. We'll average our categories, and if there's a tie, we'll just have to figure it out.
I do want to propose to you, and this is just about a little aside before we get into the review about
SPFBO.
SPFBO. Did I get it right?
You got it.
Okay. Caveat number one, if someone was confused of like, hey, the Tudor Ramble team is one of the judges.
Yeah, we're one judge.
Yes, we are one judge, two judges.
Mm.
That's one thing to note. Second, I would like to propose to you that after we finish all the other novels on the list, because we've already read Sword of Kaigan,
mm-hmm.
I would say we read Sword of Kaigan again last after everything. Just kind of put it in better context.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we're already starting off pretty high, but mm-hmm. I don't want to lean on the nostalgia factor of it so much.
Well, it's not nostalgia for me. It's one of my favorite books ever. But
exactly. You know. But you know what I mean? Like, I want to, after finishing everything else, then read it again to kind of finalize its place.
Gotcha.
So just, I wanted to propose that to you.
But right now, we are placing the second. And then there's going to be more contention in the future because then it's going to get hard to go, where does the book go? And we'll have to figure that out. We'll come prepared next episode because I knew this would be a more obvious one. Next book, we'll have to figure out how we determine that, whether we average our score. So I had gave it 4, you gave 3.75. Then if any other book also has 3.75, maybe we go, if it had a higher score from one of us. So if I gave a 5 and you gave a 3 and pretend that averaged to 3.75.
Sure.
we'll have to figure out a tiebreaker method, and then we'll just do rock, paper, scissors, whatever. We'll figure it out, but we'll come prepared next time. But this one was more obvious of where to place it. So that's the spoiler-free section aside. Now, spoiler warning, be prepared. We're going to get into the weeds of the book of Orconomics. Last chance.
All right.
Ready. Okay.
Good.
Emotional impact. What did you give it out of 5 stars?
I give the emotional impact a 3.75. Out of 5.
I give it a 4.25.
4.25.
Really great. Really great.
Really great.
I had a really great time with this, yeah.
What do you think was the emotional highlight for you of this book?
I like, first with my satires, I'll go wide first. With my satires, I like when a satire is funny because it's a satire.
Duh.
Duh. But then I also like when the satire has moments of heart.
Yeah.
I like that. I like when a satire can be funny enough to also pull back, and then it's kind of that whiplash of emotions when you're feeling so happy and so funny and all this is all jokes, but then you get the Dungeon Crawler Carl moments in books like that where then you actually have some drama in there. Now, this is way more on the satire lens. It gets to that drama toward the end, but I like, first, those things when we're talking about satire, I like that it got funny and was also actually emotional. I felt for these characters the whole time. But yeah. my general contentment throughout the whole book was, just like you said in the spoiler-free section, these characters, although you could just describe them in a word or two, I was just so into their personalities and the whole fellowship, the vibe with them, that the whole book was just fun and enjoyable for me. And I think your question was more so what was a moment or I want to loop back.
Yeah. Sure. I was asking about a moment, but your general thoughts is also fine. I'm wondering if there was a moment there for you where you had the largest emotion, like maybe an out loud moment or anything like that?
This didn't have a huge one. This was not a standout funniest moment. There were some funny moments there's a lot of just cute moments in this. I think mine is more so, what I appreciated about the whole thing was conflict in this book. It's very simple, but I appreciate it so much, is that the thing that kept me happy with this whole book, put aside the economics and the jokes and all that, was even just every character introduced had something I was interested in or some conflict I was interested in, whether it was, I have the character names, we're getting better at this.
I wrote them down as well.
Yes.
We may not pronounce them correctly, but at least we have them written down. Not going to forget totally.
It is on paper. sorry for this. This is one of those books I don't have a moment. That's why it's not spectacular for me. There's not one moment that just went like, oh, that blew my mind. This is more so consistently. So Kaitha having her drinking problems and our main character Gorm being the reluctant, they're all reluctant into this quest, but then wanting to, the coward who fled and is now an outcast, and Johan the hero is great and almighty and he wants to come back, and you see this little heart he's got for this little old goblin, and then you have your two mages who are conflicting. One is and I can say their names, here we go. One is Jin, who is the mage who
he's the Noctomancer.
He is the one who is he has the experience and studied. He's the academic. And then you have Laruna, who is the pure talent, and the opposition between those two. What I'm getting at, Jice, the silent, we'll get more into this in characters. My point is each character and the fun ride from the get-go is you're going on this fetch quest with, I don't want to compare Suicide Squad piece, it's not, but a bunch of these people who are forced to and compelled to because they've got some blackmail, some dirt on them, people who don't want to be together. It's a mess. It's going to be. And then you know where the story's going to go. You know it's going to be heartwarming. I just like that the whole entire book was, it didn't hold punches or didn't try to be anything it wasn't. And it was very, very, I read most of this book on audiobook. I was taking walks and strolls, listening to this one, going, it was very wholesome. So sorry, I gave a very generic, the whole vibe of the book I thought was very fun. Do you want to go generic? Do you agree with that? And maybe you didn't go higher than me because was there not a moment that stuck out for you? Or I guess question back at you.
I did, but
yeah.
The ending for me was far more, I was surprised how emotionally attached I was to, especially the scene with like Gleebec. Gleebec dying hit me harder than I thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see Gorm's reaction to it. It was far more emotional than I thought. So with a book like this, you kind of expect it to be a lot more funny than it is heartfelt. And I felt with this book, it was more heartfelt and I was more emotionally drawn in than I was laughing, particularly. I think especially in the beginning, I think the jokes were funny. I was having a good time. It was funny, but it started taking itself more seriously with its characters. And that was the bigger draw for me. So that, I think that was a surprise that I had with this novel.
My scope then, my satire approval is always when it's funny, but then has heart. So yeah. You like the same thing. If you like that there's actual moments to care about. Because if it's all just funny, which can happen, if it's all just funny and doesn't give you that whiplash at all, you'll remember it. But I guess a lot of comedy movies, why they can be good and not great for me, is if it's just funny the whole time. That's awesome. Scary Movie. You know those horror flicks that are just, they're archetypal purposely of the horror genre, or a B movie. They're so fun, but they won't last as long as something that is funny, but then also gives you moments to actually care about. Or think a comedy like My Cousin Vinny or other similar ones where they're funny through and through, hilarious, but then also grab you and make you care about the characters more than just... It's entertainment versus art, I guess. And the entertainment's a distraction, and this is just my subject. I'm just making a definition, but you can agree. Entertainment being a distraction, art being you reflect after reading it, and sometimes the emotional drama stuff you reflect on more. This is nothing to do with even economics. This is just generally what I think of satire. But to go more into your scene, I agree with Gleebeck and Zathustra. Nope. Zathrucka.
There you go.
And the Shadowkin dying, I didn't expect that at the end of the book as well. That was a twist and gut wrench, especially Gleebeck, of going, oh, this cute... You were listening to the audiobook too?
Yeah, I did.
How great was the voice?
I did a combo of audiobook and then also immersion reading. And yeah, the voice was so good. Yes. Especially for Gleebeck, just like, Gleebeck! Gleebeck!
That's actually...
That's pretty good.
That was the audiobook. That sounded
basically
exactly
what Gleebeck says the whole time, like, just which we find out just means, you know, hello.
Hello. That was funny too. And yeah, was there any laugh out loud moment for you, or was it more just the drama at the end is what you liked the most?
That moment was probably the funniest of we finally get Gleebeck's perspective and him talking to the the Shadow Kid, going like, Why does this gnome keep calling you hello? He's like, that's what he thinks my name is. We're just rolling with it.
That was the funniest moment.
Yeah. That was funny.
That was.
But yeah, no, that was the surprising aspect with it. With satire in general, I think this is, I am not the origin of this, but it is talked about with satire and generally in comedy in general. There are exceptions, but some of the best comedy is like when the people actually in the comedy movie shouldn't like they take it seriously.
Oh yeah,
if you're in the scene and you're delivering the punchline, you shouldn't laugh. Like, it's entirely serious to those characters.
Oh yeah.
But the audience gets to laugh. I think a lot of, and there are exceptions, like I think Monty Python really is where it's like, it doesn't take itself seriously and it works amazingly. But with this one, the interesting part is like the jokes land and the characters don't know their jokes is the right method for a satire comedy.
I think even Monty Python does that, right? Where the characters don't make a joke and then laugh at their own joke.
Yeah,
they take their weird world of Monty Python seriously.
Yeah,
as funny as that,
it's somewhat true. I think Monty Python, the Holy Grail, can kind of be more ridiculous. It's maybe its own exception. Things like with Saturday Night Live, some of the a funny aspect to it is seeing the characters and actors break under the tension, and that is funny on its own. But I do like how serious this world took itself and didn't cheapen itself by, you know, wink wink behind the curtain of these characters don't even feel real, it's just a punchline.
I agree with that too.
So
but
the reason why I'm a lower score than you overall is because through most of the book I liked it. It was enjoyable. I thought the humor was like, i gotta couple, you know, exhales out the nose, and I thought it was more clever than I expected with the economics humor of it being far more pointed. Because a thing that bothers me in general with, and I guess this will get into thought-provoking nature, really. Mm-hmm. So do you want to move on to, or is there anything else in emotional impact?
We'll cover more in characters and plot. We'll get more detailed. Just wanted to give broad stuff. So yeah, let's go to thought-provoking, and then we'll loop back.
So I gave it a 3.5. I thought it was good.
I also gave it a 3.5. I also thought it was good.
Yeah. So something that would have dropped the score a lot for me is if the message was just, hey, capitalism equals greed and greed bad, which is most of critiques of capitalism that you see nowadays is pretty piss poor in general. This one was actually pointed toward, you know, supply demand economics and then the corruption between, you know, corporation and government. Far more interesting and far more pointed at like actual the system of capital, which is funnier. And especially with everything being tied to the 2008 stock market and housing market crash.
Yeah, I do think this one leaned into, it did have the 08 crash. I did feel as though it was a broad capitalism thing as well. In that sense, of it was kind of cool how it was
That's the backdrop, but most of the funnier jokes throughout almost all of it was 2008 market references. That's what made me laugh. It's like, oh, I get what that's an allegory for. And like, that was the funny aspect. So, there are a couple handoff jokes of it's just like, haha, fantasy, but we're going to corporatize it.
Mm-hmm.
There's that, but that's not nearly as funny as the breakdown of how to do the hordes and then basically the, rating the hordes in the sense of claims and its riskiness and basically the whole idea of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac and just like taking I should not try to explain the 2008 crash in this. This is not the video. Point being, government institution basically starts rating things that are safe, as really risky, as very safe, and everything tumbles from there. Same thing happens in this book. That's funny.
Some cool points. So I guess if you're an economics major or you're just into that sphere, you'll get more references than we did. But for example, one of the references, less to do with economics and more to do with, I guess this is more capitalism. This is a capitalism critique it makes as well. That's more broad, but then points at something, is the Elvin marbles.
Oh yeah, so in reference example, to the Elgin marbles.
It's not the Elvin marbles, but it's reference to the Elgin marbles, which are the Parthenon marbles that were. Mm-hmm. It's controversial, so look into. It's actually fascinating to look into. I had an art history.
Same.
Exam or essay that I wrote on this. It was pretty cool. Back in college. Not that my essay was cool. Just a cool assignment. I don't know how I did. But the Elgin marbles are the marbles from the Greek Parthenon that was sold by the Greek government that corrupt, or I don't know the context of what was going on with the Greek government at the time, bought by Britain. Now they have it in the British Museum. Current Greece wants it back. But basically it's the Elgin marbles in the real world are in the British Museum, but they're Greek historically. They were sold at the time. Could they have sold it? Was it right to do so? Did Britain take it? There's more that I don't know about it, but that's the surface level stuff. And makes this aside to the Elvin marbles and talking about who should own it, the elves or the orcs. And this whole debate is brought up in an aside way. And part of my thought provoking is why it's a 3.5. I feel like this book does a good job thematically of it has its point it's making and it's consistent and it doesn't do anything that would make you go, oh, you're making a bad point. It refers to all these things and has solid thematic resonance throughout the whole book. Is what I'm trying to say. Of it's constant. Some books don't know what they're trying to say. I mean, it's in the title, Orconomics, but I like that it was consistent. I think why it didn't go higher for me is it was a lot of throwing things at the wall.
Reference and, without going too much further than just reference.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, and it was specific with the Elgin marbles. Mm-hmm. One, I'll just, 10, 10 toes down of like
try to get into that one. Yeah.
Yeah. The fun part, all this will be fun in the comments. Like I'm kind of on the side of the British Museum should probably keep them. The more fun question, like there's two questions, I think, is one, should the British have taken it in the first place? That's one question. And then, like, were they right in that situation? And the second question is, should they give it back now? Or, you know, should the Greeks buy it back now? Because I think one's very easy of, like...
Was that your question, too, for our history? Mine was, should they be given back?
Yes. And was that I talked about it and basically broke down the two questions of, one's a lot clearer, much clearer answer than the other, of, should the British have done what they did? Yes, obviously, because they did, like... If they didn't, it probably could have been destroyed. Like, one, just because of how basically the Parthenon is the way it is right now because it was blown up because they stored ammunition. basically, ammunition was stored in there and it blew up and destroyed a good chunk of the Parthenon itself. The British bought the marbles, even if it was a, slightly, corrupt government. They bought it in the effort to preserve history. Good. They are around today because the British did what they did. Awesome. Should they give it back? That's a different question.
Now, to the whole point that you're getting into there,
this was book, less complicated than that. Like, it's really clear. The elves are dicks. It's the orc stuff.
One is less complicated, but two is all the thought provoking stuff that we can talk about. We can have a whole podcast about that topic. The book mentions and gives a side. It's not that it ends the book and has you thinking more deeply about that subject of, oh, it's more of a reference than it is that's something that this book is now life-changing. Now I look at that situation differently or makes me appreciate that more. But like you said, it is more...
I want to give that context for that exact point of... Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of interesting discussion there of... Because I've actually been to both places, both been to British Museum, seen the Elgin Marbles, and I've
also
been...
I was there with
you. I know.
That was a great time. Yeah.
But I've also been to the Parthenon and to the Parthenon Museum and seen the place where
How was that? Cool?
It was really great. Yeah. Fantastic museum. They actually create a specific spot in the museum where the Elgin Marbles would go. This was done in an effort of showing like, hey, look, British Museum...
We're ready.
They would display well here. Yep. We have a place for it. Because one of the arguments was like, hey, we don't want to give it over to, country in hands that like won't actually properly display it. It'll display better here. Well, the Greeks were like, bet, here we go.
They came.
And by the way, that museum is amazing. Amazing museum. I get it. Like if someone says like, hey, I think the Elgin Marble should be here, it displays well. Completely understand that, but point being, there is a lot more
to talk about there,
and talk to rather than with this book just goes like elven marbles, elves bad, that's it.
Yep.
And so that happens consistently throughout the rest of the book of where I go, haha, that's funny reference, and then we move on. So that's why it's not super high.
Same here, because with the title Orconomics, with this whole focus on financial crisis, capitalism, likewise too, it does a good job at tying everything together and its theme and referring to it and having this world that is created to be a satire of capitalism. So you have the entire function of the Heroes Guilds and attacking Shadowkin are all designed, it's all designed to be essentially the house market crash. And that it was a cool way of putting into a fantasy context and very neat.
Yep.
So that was a neat part about it. Doesn't go too deeper, but the thing that I appreciated more were some of the character moments, the character lessons that were learned, which again goes to, this isn't the book that gets deep into it, but I appreciate the conflicts presented and the ideas such as talent, natural talent versus study and experience with the two mages. I think there's a lot of stuff in here that if a book was dedicated to it could be an extremely thought-provoking book. So for example, capitalism, and you see it done so poorly in a ton of books and stories and done very well in others. I'd recommend these as ones that does it super well, Parasite the film. And just as a thought-provoking thing. You could take what you will from it, but it just is an incredibly thought-provoking movie. And what's the one I'm forgetting? Daniel Day-Lewis, There Will Be Blood as well.
Yeah.
So it's they give aspects that are just, you'll take away from the film and go, oh, that's a very fascinating way of looking at things.
Yeah, so this book starts to get into something more, especially by the end, but I would say the biggest overarching capitalist theme with this is mainly class hierarchy.
Yeah.
And no, class struggle is effectively the biggest overarching theme of, I believe, the series. If I were to make a guess, I haven't read the other two, but just judging by book one and where it ends up, that's my guess, is just, you know, class struggle, which I don't know. I'm less interested in general, but we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it handles it.
I also didn't read this book to be mind blown by the themes. Yeah. I think leaned into the fun with not making it all about, look at this crazy message I'm delivering. Because I think if the book ended without the heart that we talked about and without actually making lovable characters and being a fun ride, that would fall way more flat. Because there's books that do lean into the thought provoking message of it. And if you fail at the point of your book, of course, the point is Orconomics, but I think that instead of the markets being, hey, this is a book about, I want to say something, I want to make a statement, and I'm going to find a way to make that statement. I'm going to create characters that work with that statement, and I'm going to do this. It felt more genuine that it was the characters and emotional beats and put in a setting of this Orconomics world. Rather, it felt like it was a story before it was a message.
Leads to an organic storytelling rather than trying to, you know, backward engineer your message by basically creating characters that don't feel authentic or real to make your message work. Which, if you have to do that, it does say something about your message. Maybe either you're doing it wrong, or maybe your message is false. If you have to
shoehorn in or
make characters act out of character to get your message across, that's a sign of either poor planning, just bad writing, or the message is wrong. This book does not do that. The characters are actually organic and interesting. So, good writer. Yay.
The best message of this book, though, never split the party.
Never split the party.
Never split the party. Never do that. That we see that throughout the entire book. Never split the
several
party.
Several times.
Yes. You die if you split the party. You run into people that are trying to kill you if you split the party. And that's the only reason that Gleebeck dies, is because you split the party. Gleebeck. Okay.
Oh, terrible.
Do you want to go into characters?
Yeah, let's go into it.
Okay, what'd you give out of 5 stars?
I gave it a 3.75.
This one I gave 4.25. Really great.
Now, this was a harder thing for me. I could raise it. There are some standout characters, which I think Gorm was really, really well done. Gleebeck, I would say Kaifa, the alcoholic elf, really well done. Then the rest are fine. Like, overall, like those are kind of the standout characters for me. The rest, I see some inklings of, like, oh, there's something more to them. But I would say, like, especially the two wizards, I liked them. And there was a lot of focus on it, but I wasn't, you know, in love with them. Especially, I think, Heraldin,
the bard.
Not thief.
The bard, yes.
The bard.
The not thief.
Is definitely, he's supposed to be a significant character, but definitely seems like a book two character of, like, okay, we're going to put him off to the side. We'll go into him later. So there's a lot of characters like that, which didn't grab me. So that was why, like, I think it's really good, but not great.
That makes sense. I think I think I found this too to be the case. When it comes to a cast of characters, the more you give, that just hints to more depth, or hints to more, like, it's very easy to go, okay, that character is that archetype, but also their personality stands out on the page. Orconomics, at the very least, the fellowship of characters and the band, as you're going across. I cared about each one in a different way. For I think the most interesting part about, I'm going to get the names right as well, like Kytha was Kytha, but also Thane. Thane, who loved Kytha. Thane was such a cool outside character to kind of bring in and protect just to refresh people. Thane was the possible king in the woods that was singing songs and protected Kytha, but Kytha doesn't know who's actually, she feels like there's this constant presence of someone's protecting her, but she doesn't know what it is. She thinks it's this ominous king in the woods, but it's really this big shadowkin troll. Yeah. And
definitely had one of the darkest moments is Thane and Kytha had one of the darker moments in this book, which you want to go like just mentioning it of Kytha, due to her addiction, she's addicted to healing potions, which I thought was really interesting. World building stuff of like, okay, that one, it makes a lot of sense of like one, painkillers being addictive, all the stuff. Like now you have healing potions.
That was so cool.
Have like up another level. But to drink a healing potion to get that high, you have to hurt yourself. And like, so people will deliberately get hurt or they will cut off. They'll cut themselves just to drink a healing potion. And so you have Kytha sitting on top of a rock, which is Thane. And Thane has to watch as Kytha cuts herself open to then drink another healing potion. And just like then, her blood dripping all over him. And it's like this person that he now loves. Ooh.
That's dark. What we're talking about. It's not just satire. It gets deeper.
Yeah.
And that could also have been something we said in Thought Provoking. This is just a message about addiction, which it takes it seriously. And the healing potion aspect is just such a cool fantasy orconomics way of putting this. I'm trying to think of the word. Dungeons and Dragons, that kind of style of storytelling to tell. And I think Thane and Kytha's moments there were awesome because you constantly see that the thing that all the characters do or what is done really well is character conflict. I know one of our huge complaints about when in truth, or when you read a book void of character conflict or just where it seems like a veneer, it's horrible and frustrating. I appreciated that every character in here, even if they just had one major conflict, which most of them did, it made everybody interesting. So Gorm had his conflict of he was no longer with Jonah the Mighty. And he fled when it came to one of their most important, this big villain it was referred to, but we haven't seen the scene quite yet.
Yeah.
But there's this, it actually was so horrifying that Geist, the other person in their fellowship, is silent, a mute since that event happened, which kind of builds this more suspense of what exactly happened that made Geist go silent and made our main protagonist flee. It's referred to a little bit, but then we have... So Gorm Ingerson, his past, and he's taking on this quest. One, because he's compelled to. they're all forced to, but also there's this hope that he does get back into the hero's guard, does gain his reputation back. He would like to have that. And Gorm, you always love seeing these kind of curmudgeon characters that on their outside seem like such a tough guy. Carl, he seems like such a tough guy, but really you do care for little Gleebec. And really you're walking Thane, the troll, for example, also is at first saying, no, I'm not keeping the secret. I'm not doing it. Okay, I'll keep the secret to a point. But he's constantly doing punches the elf. And punches the elf and protects Gleebec. Does that because he has a heart. So he's constantly showing this exterior, but you've seen this before, but it's so good to see that character conflict. Then you have
it's also the struggle of what he wants versus him doing what is right.
Yep.
And so you dangle in front of him the object of his want and then his actual need of like why does he hate himself? Why does he have this, self-loathing?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is probably more due to he does have the memory issues, but like he believes he did something wrong. Not that he lost everything. It's that he regrets his actions. And so I think now you dangle of like, oh, here's the thing you said you always wanted. And then he finds out, like, I actually don't need that. I need to, I actually need to be satisfied with my own moral choices and living the life that I want to live rather than just what is dictated and the things that I want. So that I like Gorm a lot as well.
Gorm is sweet. And Gleebec, sweet, of course. Did you have any thoughts about Kaitha beyond that scene as well? Did you also think that each character, because I think that scene was the best for Kaitha and Thane, but each character like Kaitha had a central conflict, addiction for her.
Mm-hmm.
Gorm just talked about. And then we have the mages who maybe you didn't... Oh, God.
I just want to say with Kaitha specifically, I think the way Zachary handles addiction is fantastic, especially with more of a... people handle addiction very differently, but the functional alcoholic is the kind of trope that Kaitha is. And I guess it's wrong to say trope, but you get what I mean.
Archetype
or aspect of the human character with addiction, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But Kaitha is a functional addict. And you see how much that she has to hide away her addiction, how much she struggles to show, she does perform pretty well, but then the other aspects of hiding an addiction with an addiction, of that she pretends to be an alcoholic so she could hide her addiction to the healing potions, which I thought was... really poignant. I really enjoyed that aspect of the character dynamics, especially how the length she goes to try and hide it, and willing to, I think that just really shows the depth of how much of a problem it is if you're willing to show make up this lie of that is shameful for her, but that is better than the deeper shame that, especially in this world in Orconomics, of how healing potion addicts are treated and seen.
Mm-hmm.
So lovely. I probably my favorite character is Kaitha.
Nice.
Throughout the consistently from beginning to end, I'm most invested in her character.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I was giddy with Gleebec and Gleebec's fun.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Best character, best boy, Gleebec. But I was probably most invested in Kaitha.
That's a great point, because I think... what you said there makes me think that, yes, it was just a conflict, but the conflict is actually done very well. It's one layer, even if it's one layer of she's making this look as though she's addicted to alcohol, because that's a more acceptable thing to be shamed of. Is so well done, and being a functional, I didn't even think about it that way. That's great. My favorite dynamic was even between one character we haven't mentioned yet, Niln. And Niln and Gorm, so remind people, Niln was the Almontran. He was supposed to be the seventh hero in this quest. And this entire quest happened in the first place, which we'll get into the plot, but this entire quest happened in the first place because Niln is looking for... He's talking to the Almontran god, and I'm saying that correctly, I believe. Almontran faith, yes. The Almontran faith. And looking for, he's the seventh hero, he's looking for this band of characters to go complete this quest, and Niln is the one who believes with his own writing, he has written into existence that he is the seventh hero. And he has this very, his dynamic with Gorm Ingerson is Gorm is the real leader of the group and tribe. Niln starts off being the leader and starting off the quest, but very quickly it's shown that he is not actually the one people look to when it comes to actually making a decision, where every single time shit hits the fan, Gorm is the one coming up with the plan. And even Niln, when he says, yes, we're going to do this, right, Gorm? Gore. Is that right? And he has this slow realization throughout the story that he's really not the seventh hero, both religiously, this faith that he wrote himself, but actually genuinely believes in, but also he just starts to believe in Gorm more. And see, it's this really cool dynamic to see Niln not have this this caricature of being the evil ego person that is all into themselves and does think that they're the seventh hero, where Johann the Mighty is your antagonist, who is that character. Oh, something go on? That one? Okay. But then we have Gorm by the end of this and talking to Niln, the last parting words that they say to each other, and Niln ends up dying at the hands of Flynn, I believe is his name, dies at the hands of Flynn. But we had a little mini character arc with Niln in this book. So we got that. We got that completed on Niln. But then on Gorm and Niln, their kind of dynamic throughout the story was cool to see. Gorm being the one that is the reluctant curmudgeon who ends up being the actual leader of the troop, who didn't want to start this to begin with. Niln being the one that wanted to lead the group and had all these hopes and ideals and realized that that wasn't his place in the world. It was cool to see how their character arcs intertwine. I feel like each character, why elevated for me, is each character had somebody to bounce off of. So the two mages, for example, had each other to directly bounce off of, where you had this little mini love arc between them, but quickly realized that Jin and Lorena, Jin being do you have the word down? I didn't write it down.
I believe it's Noctomancer.
Noctomancer. And we have Jin's character who is experienced, or he has studied, he has all the knowledge, and looks at Lorena and knows that she is more talented and has this natural talent, but wouldn't use the magic in the correct way. Would be too untamed with it. And so you see them combat, and eventually we see how Jin's father was actually the character we saw in the prologue. In the prologue of the book, we find out that we see that this person is trying to be married off to Johann the Mighty. Is trying to be married off to Jin. And we see Johann the Mighty come and save the day. And this character doesn't have to go and marry Jin.
Basically, the father of Jin is Daetar Urmian. And
good, write down. Yeah.
There you go. See, I wrote that. Yeah. Wrote the name down. And we find out later in the book is now a necromancer.
Yeah.
Or actually Lich. I'm bad at pronouncing it.
Book two is called Lich. Son of a Lich. So I'm imagining it's going to be a lot about Jin.
So this is Lich, powerful Lich. And so Jin has lied about his origin, but for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. And Jin stands up for himself afterwards. So he kind of comes back to the group and is going, hey, this was not my fault. My father put me in and arranged this marriage. This was not something that I was set out for. And I've been living my whole life trying to get rid of this reputation of not being who my father is and starting on this bad footing. And I look at what I've done with my life and accomplished all these things. And now I was blackmailed in order to come to this group. Everybody kind of has their own baggage. Mm-hmm. Jin does learn of this. Geist is one of the characters. What do you think about the Silent Geist and Harald and the Bard? What depth did you see to them? Because those other characters were the standouts. What about them?
Harald is definitely the weakest link of the group in terms of just emotional connection to the character. Like, clearly it's a character that was a thief and now wants to be a bard, got it, trying to change, run away from their past and change who they are. Run away is the wrong term to use, but just change from who they once were and what they have done and try to lead a different life. Fair enough, has his own baggage, but like, we don't get a lot from him other than him hitting, the whole bard thing hitting on, Kaitha. So, like, you get that. Ha ha, funny. Bard. Mm-hmm. Got it. But other than that, nothing. Then, which is one of the reasons of just lowered score in characters. And then Geist. Yeah, Geist had somewhat of a presence there. Definitely a little bit more emotionally hitting by the end when you find out, his name, Ehin the Red, or is basically, Geist is in the Shadow Tongue, one seeking death. So he's basically on a suicide march, just trying, but he's just too good at fighting to die. So I'm interested to see where he'll be in book two.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Yeah, well, these characters come down to, and you also have the antagonist, Goldson and Bags, and these, mm-hmm. they're more caricatures, and you can see that they're the villains. They're the capitalists of the story.
Yeah, what is the two characters from the Eddie Murphy movie of, like, switching places or something?
Oh, I don't know. Which movie?
Swapping Places, is it? Eddie Murphy, like, basically
plays two
two stock market hedge fund managers, which I was imagining from them, of they have a bet and saying, like, is it money that makes someone successful, or is it, you know, their personality? One says, like, hey, I could take a homeless person and put them into a hedge fund manager's role and they'd be just as successful. The other's like, no, it's the person, and I'd be able to climb their way up. Anyway, hijinks ensue. They swap places, and they get their comeuppance and all these things. But point being, that's the reference I saw, at least how I took it.
Yeah.
They seemed very similar, but...
Cool. Anyway. The point is, these characters have personality, and it's the personality that's going to be the forefront, and there's this inserted conflict and depth that we'll get more of in the trilogy. But I found all of them to be very rootable, all the fellowship to be very rootable, and just fun to watch and follow. Now, were they completely irreplaceable and going, man, nobody's like them? No, there's characters similar, and of course they have these similar backstories and backdrops to others, but all of them as a unit makes it fun to follow. I think when you have more characters with lots of conflicts going on, it could feel as if you're more a part of a group. And now let's say this was just a story with just Gorm and Gleebec. Now you have to focus on them more and have more depth. And I guess an example of this would be Dungeon Crawler Carl, where it's really focused early on before, not spoiling the series, but obviously there's a fellowship in that series as well. But starts off with Carl and Donut, and it's how deep are those characters to begin with? How much of their personalities do you enjoy and are attached to begin with? And this is doing a similar thing that these other Kings of the Wild type stories do. It's your fellowship. How much are you attached to their personalities?
Yeah. There's also something that I'm hoping we see from book two.
Yeah.
What I do enjoy from these kind of fellowship stories, especially with, you know, characters conflicting with each other. In this book in particular, there does seem to be, like, the pairing.
Yeah.
There's basically... two characters are mostly in conflict, and they bounce off each other and feed each other's character highlights and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. What I enjoy from a really good fellowship story is you see that, but then you see, like, how one character will maybe be bitter conflict with another, but then you see their dynamic with another. And, like, I like the interplay of character interactions being drastically different between the characters. With this one, other than the pairings, there doesn't seem to be too much of a dynamic, but they don't cross the streams. Like, you don't see much of a relationship between Kaitha and the wizards, or Haraldin, or Geist, or... And the only thing you get is from Gorn of, like, she respects him well enough. Gorn being, you know, gnome, is, like, not hitting on her, and so she's like, ah, that's kind of nice. And, you know, finally some guy not hitting on me. That's a welcome change of pace. But other than that, there's mutual respect and there's not much else there yet. Maybe we'll see some more. But yeah, no, I wanted some more interplay between, like, you have the standard pairing and then you see how they interact with different ones. I don't know. That's kind of what I was looking for. I'm hoping we get that more in book two.
Do you want to go on to plot then?
Yeah.
So plot, what'd you give out of 5 stars?
3.25. Above average.
I give it a 4-star. Great, great plot. And why 3.25? What did you feel that this book was promising at the beginning? Did you get it? Were you just above average for you?
Yeah, I think the plot overall I thought it was fine. Mm-hmm. In basically the first half was fine, and then the second half was significantly better.
Mm.
That's basically it. I think I was ultimately satisfied by the end, and I think the ending is significantly better than the beginning, and that's kind of why I'm off, like, it's above average. Maybe I probably would have been higher if I liked the first half a lot more.
Yeah. Okay. The book starts off, we mentioned that prologue. The book starts off with this wedding happening, and the very first line of the book, which you read to me in the spoiler-free section before when we were doing that video, is, as a general rule, signs are too subjective a topic for polite company. Where one man sees a sign of blessings to come, another sees bad tidings, and a third is puzzled by the animated discussion his companions are having about an oddly shaped piece of toast. With so much disagreement regarding the meaning of portents, let alone whether there is a meaning at all, it's seldom wise to discuss them. All things considered, however, it's probably safe to say, without fear of controversy, that a crying bride is a bad sign. Starts off like that. So there's this crying bride who does not want to get married to who we later found out is Jin, and Johan the Mighty comes to save the day. And the cool kind of hook with this story, or I guess your expectations going in, is you have this Heroes Guild that is going around attacking Shadow Fiend who aren't NPCs, non-combatant paper carriers. Yes, I believe that's correct. And from the get-go, I was really into the concept of the book and having this Heroes Guild who goes around it, and you're marketizing D&D, you're marketizing these quests and hero guilds. And that was a cool start to this. And then, of course, to tell the story properly, we have Gorm, who was in one of the Heroes Guild and now is not in favor because he fleed, and you have this knight in shining armor, Johan the Mighty. Thank you.
Sorry, I knew we were going to see that down there.
We could say the character names right, but not other words. Just one or the other. Damn it. And the start of the book, expectations going in, or having the setup, is Gorm Ingerson not being in favor and fled from this quest. And Johan the Mighty is seen in all these regards, and he's this knight in shining armor. So great start and expectation to this book for me. I love the hook. I love the concept of you go around having to attack Shadow Fiend in order to get money and complete quests and get further in this hierarchy. And heroes are only a percentage as well of the total market that actually happens. But the entire market of Carmelby's heroes have to get certain number of loot that is given and dispersed in this kind of way, and that's where you get into the more of the satire of the book. But very cool way of setting this up. And it's even said in the book as well from Gorm, and going, wait, this is just a simple fetch quest? What? I guess with these quote-unquote simple plots, you could describe the plot pretty briefly and quickly, but the simple plots like this, what the trick I always like and what I want to see in these kind of stories, Zachary Pike does, where he gives you the fetch quest and you have the goal and you have you know exactly what you're in on the ride for. And so when you are given that as just this general plot advice or analysis, sure, that I think, but when you're given a plot like that and you say, hey, this is the goal of the book or the movie. I'll give an example too of everybody's probably seen, but I won't completely spoil it. I'll just say general things, but Top Gun Maverick is a movie that very, very simple plot, incredibly simple. It's do this mission by the end of the movie. And I'll keep it very spoiler light, but this has a similar thing of, hey, you need to go get these marbles and you need to decide, give them to the elves or give them to the orcs. And it was the orcs, right? You have to, this is your quest. Now, quest is given, shenanigans ensue, which we could talk about all the fun in between, that progress and the fun, which I thought was great. But then the end of the quest happens and you're like, oh, we accomplished that. And you find out this cool twist where Jin's father, it was actually Jin's father, and there's a whole plot that he's got going on in the background. What's that all about? But it kind of ends more simply than you would have thought it would. And you go, oh, we succeeded. It was still a fun finale and you did it. That's great. But then, like in Top Gun Maverick, and you have these movies where you get the payoff you think you wanted, but plot twist, here's the real payoff. It's just this general plot cool thing that authors do that I appreciate a lot, or just storytellers, mm-hmm, of here's what we told you was going to happen, but here's the second actual climax, which is the part you're talking about, which you love so much, but so much more, that mm-hmm, that second oomph, that's
yeah, the second yeah, ending, the second climax, ending.
Yeah,
really.
And that was cool to see, because then we get the actual stakes are involved of, okay, we had a fun ride, this is great, and you have, I like when the, even if you could see it coming or not, it's, I didn't see it coming, where you have the constant theme of never split the party is always brought up, and you finally think the quest is over. And since the quest is over, we actually have the party splitting off. Niln goes his own way. Kalipek goes his own way. And you get this, okay, we're in the resolution now of the book. How is this going to end and set us up for book two? Wait a second. Remember that thing we were warning about the whole book, about don't split the party, don't do this? Oh, no, we did it, because it wasn't actually over. There was this plot in the background where Flynn sent them on this quest to begin with in order to fail. They wanted to kill the main character. Sorry, I'm just describing the whole plot to get us into this too. Yeah. I like the book more, so
go ahead.
Yeah. So then you have the actual background conflict was Flynn was just sending them all and wanted this quest to happen in the first place, just so they die. And the thieves that they run into in the fourth, that Kaitha runs into, was actually meant to kill them. And the fellowship here was their contingency plan to begin with. So we kind of fill in the dots of, oh, all the things we did on the journey, all the things that we actually ran into, wasn't just a fun and games plot point, but all came in to the end to actually matter to the conclusion of the book. So
coincidences that you think of, like,
yeah,
okay,
they ran into these thieves.
All of a sudden, they run along the thieves, and like, hey, the Elgar Mar was like just there, and they found it.
So yes.
Like, okay.
I guess they get it, right? Okay. Yeah,
and it was all done with purpose.
Mm-hmm. And it's cool to see that a very cool way to pay off, why I felt the payoff as well, is all these things that are seemingly random or just this quest that's fun, you can do in a plot. And if it's fun and never comes back and is never alluded to again, that's a decent plot of, oh, we had a fun time. But when a plot is so purposeful and well-crafted where all the fun and games that ensue, then in the finale matter. So the orcs that we see, who actually their whole culture was neat too, where they were just trying to sell stuff. You know, they were just there, which I thought was
aggressive seller.
That was, oh my God, why did I say that for emotional moments? That was the funniest scene for me, of when they took them all and they felt so threatened and pressured, like, oh my God, we're going to die. They're going, wait, so why did you capture us and blindfold us? Oh, we wanted to give you like an exclusive look and like give you the best treatment and make sure we isolated our buyer so that
we're isolating our buyer to like
we wanted to treat you right and give you a personalized experience. Like, what do you mean? So they looked at the way they looked at things was, oh no, this isn't us capturing you and doing you wrong. This is marketing.
This is aggressive sales tactics. Yeah.
And that was,
we took your weapons because we wanted to show you like that your weapons are inferior to our new supply.
Product. Honestly, I was sold. They could sell me a pen any day. So you have all these fun shenanigans ensue, but in the end, they all get slaughtered and connect to the larger plot point about what where were the marbles and where were they supposed to go in the first place. They already knew that Gorm was going to give this to the Shadowkin because, look, he had Gleebeck as his friend the whole time. He punched the elf. So even that scene where he punched the elf comes back full circle of, oh, they knew that this would be Gorm's decision in the end. Basically, my whole point is that just as a plot, very well crafted and was more than I expected going in. Of this was both fun and paid off and gave me a lot to cheer for, root for, and the fun and games portion like that. It was funny, fun ride. So that's why I thought this was very, very well crafted. So,
yeah, in all honesty, I will raise my plot here, especially my 0.25 back up to 3.5.
Good plot.
Cool. Yeah, good plot.
Good. Yeah, I see that. I think with the just describing that as well, I can't get more like that. That's it. That's all I got. It is a simple plot, but I had a great, I think great as far as when we're asking plot, very few versus lots of changes. There's really not much I would change about this. I thought it was a very solidly crafted book, but I also see your point with the latter half being better. I see that with it. It really picked up even more.
Well, there's also stuff in the beginning, which I think, so all the stuff between the two wizards, to me, I think is one of the more they spend a lot of time with it, and I think ultimately is kind of lacking. It feels that it takes up a lot of time in the plot, but also somehow is also rushed. It's weird. I don't know. I think the pacing with that whole plot line was, I would have changed some things about it.
Are you talking about the scene where they do start to fall in love a bit? And does it seem too sudden?
Yeah,
for you,
both sudden and also there's a lot of time dedicated to it, which is strange. But I think that's mostly a plot issue for me. But that would be something that would be a significant plot details I would change. But other than that, yeah, I would probably increase some of the stakes in the beginning.
I think for the make sure I'm getting it right again, Jin, that mage, why it's focused on more is his father being the antagonist at the end, mm-hmm. and the next book being Son of a Leech. I imagine so. His character is very important for this book, and I think the folk.
I do think it's Lich.
Lich,
please correct me in the comments.
Do you see how traumatized Rich and I are from all of you? Of us just trying to get our words right?
We're doing our best.
I'm shivering, okay? I am so self-doubting going, wait, how do you say book. The book is good. Yes.
Book, damn it. Ah, shoot.
You've traumatized us, okay? People are going to be like, guys, stop pronouncing it right. It's distracting from you actually talking about the book. Let us know if we're overcorrecting, okay? Yeah. So, that point about Jin and having that focal point, I think that was, I think I disagree. I liked the focus on it, and it made sense because his father being an antagonist point at the end and there being a deeper past or history to him. Also, I think the scene where it happens more suddenly, I see your point, because it's like, but I guess in your head you fill in how many times were they training together or learning together. Like, you don't want to go through a whole training arc in mid book of like, oh, this is every scene that they're doing together. So I didn't see as much of an issue, but the what about the stakes at the beginning, that portion?
Like, I do get your point of it is supposed to seem very simple fetch quest, and then it turns into something far more complicated, and like, I get that.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I was not invested in the stakes. I'm just kind of having an okay time, but it was pretty easy for me to put down overall. It was just like, okay, we're having a fun time. Reference fun economic things and neat.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I maybe would have added something a bit more grabbing there in the plot.
This is basically when Coop says book good. This is your definition. Oh, book good.
Book good. Yeah.
This is good time.
Yeah. If like edges into book really good.
Almost there.
Almost there. In all honesty, I probably should get like it. Especially with how it ends. It's like the
do
ending,
you want to read
the
on?
Ending is great. The rest of the book is good. So it should,
it should be really,
really good.
Good.
Yeah. I'll adjust.
All right.
Just
all right.
The ending did
we
bring
got
a lot.
There.
Like, especially a book that makes you like going, oh yeah, I really want to read the next book.
Yeah.
Probably should be really good. That's a really good book.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's another thing this does too, is I want to read on.
Yeah.
I've heard that the trilogy is completely solid as well, that this book is of the same or the future ones are better quality, so I'm excited for that. Mm-hmm. But anything else with plots, as far as you want to get in the weeds of any trope or story type, or like specific thing about the plot that you want to point out other than that?
I guess we kind of mentioned it a little bit in the character section, but there are plenty of characters with plot points where do you think the focus on the wizards came at the sacrifice of your other characters that basically got no time in the plot spotlight, of they were just kind of there and existed, of Geist, of Heraldin. Personally, I think Nilm was fine, but I wasn't to invest in that character, and I think a lot of it is because a good chunk of time went to the wizards and not a lot went to them, and so that was kind of why I was thinking of like the change of it was both a lot and also sudden. What are your thoughts to that?
Oh, I didn't mind. I think that the two characters they were focused on, one again because of who his father ended up being, the importance of his character, but also they had more direct conflict. The other ones, you met, as you said in the character section, it's not like they interwove and all had a thought and opinion about each person as directly. I didn't mind that. And sorry, I'm already forgetting some plot details because it's been a couple weeks since I read it. It's been like, 3 weeks? Longer for you.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting some of the nuance because I know there was more with Geist and Heraldin that I'm just not thinking of right now.
They are mostly a setup.
Yes.
book two stuff is probably going to happen.
I know, but we're missing a point that happened that made me care more. Like, they had something going on that I liked. I forget what it was, but whatever you're about to comment, I liked it. Whatever they had going on
was
fun.
I wanted more of the plot. I wanted them to have more significance to the plot of this book is basically my point.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I didn't mind that as much. I think this one, I guess the focus of this book was Gorm, obviously, Niln putting the thing together, and Niln and Gorm's swapping of roles, a simpler way of putting it. Mages conflicting the whole time and getting a little bit of that that mini falling in love and then learning there was a secret that you never knew about and then feeling deeply betrayed. And then that kind of connected back to the plot point with Thane. And this is my favorite plot point as well, was Thane's plot and how he integrated with the heroes. I'll jump to the point I was making and go back to Thane. But Gorm tells Thane why he has to kind of reveal, hey, I can't keep the secret anymore, because look, hey, you don't keep a secret from your guildmates. You don't do that. Look what just happened here. It turns out his father was.
You don't keep secrets like that. That could affect the rest of the team.
Exactly.
That's the caveat of.
Exactly.
And I will say that is a plot detail that I appreciated more than it's done in other stories.
Yeah.
Of the classic, you know, characters who are in love and then, you know, was like, you've kept this thing from me and you lied by omission, and so I don't, you know, you betrayed me. Where it's
Akatar.
Like, yes, but like, you kind of just met, you're both working out, like, why is he going to tell your deepest, darkest secret? Yeah. Like, to this person, like, you do need to build more trust. It's not something you're gonna tell on a third date type of deal.
Usually you withhold that, yeah.
Normally. However, in this novel, I think there was a really good, it was well set up that Laruna, like, did open her heart to Jin and told her some, like, deep, her secrets about her past, of, like, basically gave Jin an opening of, like, this was the moment. Instead of just, like, she was vulnerable and told a pretty big secret. And that was the point for Jin to, like, if you're going to open up,
yeah,
that would be the time. And so it wasn't like there was no real opportunity for it. There was no real connection. It was both relevant to their future, is relevant to the guild, and it's important for their safety. And she gave him a good opportunity, and he still didn't. That's where, and then, so by the end, we're just like, you kept this from us, and him going, like, I had to keep this secret. And she was like, you're one of the people on the council, and I told you this deep, dark secret that could actually get me removed from the council, but I trusted you. That feeling of betrayal of, like, okay,
you clearly
don't trust me as much as I trusted you, and that's the rift, makes sense.
Yes.
That, I liked that plot point. It was actually handled well.
Yes.
As I've seen that handled very poorly in other stories.
Versus, why would you expect it if you're just meeting this person, you haven't been vulnerable with this person.
Yeah.
And you try, in those other type of books, it seems like you're vulnerable. Oh, look, I'm opening up, I'm talking about something. But on this regard, why it's so vulnerable is what she's revealing is actually matters so much. And it's actually a secret, versus if you're just giving something, it's all quid pro quo. Everything has to be returned, but a level of trust was given and not returned. And it just doesn't feel like
the argument that they had afterward ultimately was like the chips were laid down, and she was like, yeah, you clearly don't trust me.
Yep.
Fair enough. And like, I can't be with someone that doesn't trust me.
Yeah.
The same that I trust them.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that, anything else you want to mention with plot?
No. Anything else for you?
No, that is it.
All right.
All right.
Moving on to world building.
What'd you give?
I gave it a 3.25, above average.
I gave this a 4-star, right?
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So, world, vibes.
Vibes are fun.
Vibes are fun.
Vibes are pretty cool.
Should have gave it a 5 for that, but I couldn't do that. But
if we're on the bookborn scale of vibes.
It was a 5-star
vibes.
It was
a 5-star vibes, yeah.
So what did you think?
Maybe this is just my prejudice on D&D-centered, like, stories. In general,
okay.
Of I don't know. I'm just not as enticed by generic D&D setting worlds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just my interest. I think for that kind of trope, this was handled really well for that. But then we get back into the thought-provoking nature of a lot of the stuff is references rather than going a little bit deeper. We'll probably go into deeper connections in book two. But for this one, it was above average for me.
Makes sense. I think the this is one of those things where, okay, I'll list off a couple books and not go into spoilers for all of them. But there's different types of world-building atmospheric books for me. And I put this in the category of, I'll say like, Blood Over Brighthaven, Will of the Many. Let's see what else comes to mind. Can I find Emperor's Soul, maybe even that one? Okay, all three of those, what those have in common when I'm looking at a book like this, is they have a feature, whether it's a little magic system nugget or an idea, that makes me go, oh, that's fun. I'm immersed. I like this world. I'm a fan. And why I kind of mentioned that is the other books just mentioned. For example, The Will of the Many has this magic system about, oh, you give your will to somebody, but, and that has implications in the plot, da da da. But cool idea that just makes me go, oh, what a neat way of doing this and putting it in, what a neat way of using that mechanic in your story, and gets me immersed. So I was more hooked and immersed in the idea of this world and execution as well, of course, but the idea of the world from the get-go of being NPCs who are these Shadowkin who have to get papers in order not to be hunted by the Heroes Guild, which is just one of many that are a part of this grand Orconomics percentage of who actually gets what kind of loot. And the entire point of the book, getting back to the 08 financial crisis and where this falls to, essentially was just a cool way of telling the story of a seen before infinite number of times quest, fetch quest, D&D style campaign, where this was now put in a world where all these ideas all were thematically and in its world immersive. So I think what I'm kind of giving it credit toward is the for example, we run into the fun and games portion of the book. When I'm saying fun and games, I mean middle of book. So that portion where we meet the other Shadowkin and they're selling the gadgets, for example. The culture and this economy is even pushed into the Shadowkin and these that they find on their quest. Like everything is centered around money. Even the characters you run into have this mindset about selling you a cool gadget because that is the world of Orconomics. Just as bare bones or basic as that is, that's where it was very consistent and cool because that idea was everywhere.
That nugget idea was thoroughly integrated.
There was nowhere where it was broken or not immersed. And also, I just like the creativity that it took. I like the creativity. I don't want to show the socks.
Really. Not for free.
Not for free.
Not in this Orconomics.
Got to get paid.
Not in this economy.
Capitalism. By the way, talk about money. Join our book club. We didn't mention that yet.
Oh,
if you want to talk about books.
We didn't follow the message of Orconomics.
Sell,
sell, sell.
Did we learn? Because the one time we don't mention book club so far in our spoiler-free section, we didn't talk about it.
I know.
Wow.
Damn.
And our merch.
Yeah, I'm wearing pants from our merch store.
And you're wearing Talking Stories shirts.
And Talking Stories merch.
Go get their merch if you really want.
don't buy our merch. Buy Talking Stories merch. Actually, I don't.
They have merch still, yeah.
No, they don't have shirts though anymore.
Oh, they don't?
Like that was a limited time.
Get their other stuff. It's great.
They got other things?
Yes, they do. Go to Talking Story. Buy their stuff. Look, we learned our lesson. We're not selfish.
We're not complete shills. Just 47% shill.
Why 47?
Yeah. Just below 50.
You pick a number.
Yeah, so that's the thing.
That's really what I have to say about the world. It's just consistent tone, consistent feel, fun ride. When I was reading it, never broke immersion.
Fair enough.
But anything else from you? Just above average? D&D feels?
Above average for me. I was like relatively immersed.
Yeah.
Thought it was fun, but like, yeah, I wasn't that invested in the world itself.
Fair. And sorry, I'm not mentioning more. I didn't take enough notes about the world, but I know there was a lot of cool features that I'm forgetting right now.
We mentioned the Elgin Marbles being, you know, this kind of story feature of like the cultural references. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is most the world building elements is real world references and just the fantasy term and change a letter here. And there we go.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Anything else with world?
Nope.
All right. Pros out of 5 stars?
Out of 5 stars. And this is where, honestly, I should raise it. I initially have here a 3.25. Okay. However, I think I do want to give it a 3.5. I think it is good. Mainly the consistency. The jokes do land, which, hey, that's an important feature of a comedy book. The jokes need to land. I think the jokes land far more often than not. And I like the dialogue between the characters. There's some incredibly moving scenes, but also funny scenes. It's well done. It's good.
I get 3.75. Very good. Really good. So yeah, for those reasons, the satire, the fun quirkiness, it's not Terry Pratchett prose where it's just so witty and multi-layered. It leans more toward the on the nose, but does some creative things with it. For example, here's one quote I really appreciated. Not all who wander are lost. Some are on quests. And yeah. Marketing is its own kind of magic, is it not? Said Zarathustra. An illusion that men pay to be fooled by. Oh, okay. these fun ways of putting this, making a lot of, not puns, puns is the wrong word, just making references and things that are like pointing fingers and going, aha, I get that one. Ah, that's cute and humorous. Obviously, the not all who wander are lost, a Tolkien reference. Cute, funny. Well, like it.
Isn't that technically not even a Tolkien line? It's actually just Peter Jackson.
No, that's Tolkien. What do you mean?
Oh, that's no, I'm Tolkien. Thinking different one of
which one?
You know, wizards are never late.
Yeah, they arrive precisely when they mean to.
That is a Peter Jackson original.
It is. And exactly.
Amazing that that's lovely. A Peter Jackson original.
That's incredible.
That's a different video.
That's incredible about it. Oh. But yes, really good prose. I think we read that paragraph off earlier. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should start making this more of a tradition. I'm going to read the last paragraph. How did it end? So how can we feel? Oh, I don't want to read ahead. I think it gave us snippets. Okay, there we go. Let's see if, I don't know. I don't remember the last paragraph here. Okay. Jelena leaned back in her seat as he approached. You go back to Andoran, the dwarf snarled, fire blazing in his eyes. And you tell Johan not to pay any mind to what you've done, because it's a drop in the bucket, you hear? We're coming for justice, even if we have to burn the world to get it. And as sure as the north winds blows cold in the winter, nothing will stand in our way. Oh, a little bit of a less prose, but just we should have mentioned that in the plot stuff going forward too. That is very major.
Oh yeah, no, it's taken a major turn of like they are going the terrorist route, fantasy terrorism. We're gonna leave that there.
I was like, what do I follow up with that?
How do you follow that one up?
Fantasy terror, where's the joke? Nope, it's not finding it.
There's no joke. There's just
explosions.
It is interesting in the context of this fantasy book, exclusively in this fantasy book, in no way, shape, or form, outside this fantasy book. I hope I'm not misconstrued. At all.
We are so cooked with AI. We're so
probably.
They don't even need to take our voice and try to create words. I think we said every word. So you could just take our words that we've ever said on this podcast and whatever. You've said everything now.
Oh, yeah.
There's
yeah.
not a it's, word it's in the that we know of, because obviously our language is very, we're not that well versed in.
We big dum-dums.
Language. So,
we have not mastered the English lexicon, as it were.
That's why. So, I've always had this passion, not this passion, this want, this kind of COVID want, where, you have all this time in the world, go learn a language, that kind of thing. I know I studied Spanish just in school, so I know some Spanish. I know Italian just from my nani, nano, et cetera. So, able to hear things and get basic stuff. That's where I'm at. But then every time I get that push to want to learn a language and go, I need to study. I want to be fluent in Italian. Or how cool would that be if I was fluent in Japanese or Mandarin or Korean, something. That would just be awesome and impressive. And I would want to go to a culture and then just be able to speak. Always get these kind of really, you get inspired. Then I take a step back and go, have I mastered English? Can I even speak my native tongue that well? And go, if I'm not speaking my native tongue even in the top 10 percentile, do I deserve to even be in in conversation in another language. It's something that I just think about and go, how can I learn another language if I'm not even competent in this one?
In general, I do agree with you.
Yeah. I'm exaggerating point, but you go,
I do agree.
We read because we're trying to be better worded and individuals.
We're trying to be adequately better linguists.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Let's go, team us. So to that last point in the book, they're now going into book two with a fervor.
With a vengeance. Justice.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they have this energy going in the book too that I'm very excited for. Mm-hmm. I know this whole point was prose, but prose, really good. Good to you. Satirical, fun, witty at times. Not Terry Pratchett, but also Nicholas Eames-esque prose. I would say in that way of Kings of the Wild. If you've read that, I would say it's near to even above that kind of writing. So
yeah, I agree.
Anything else about Orconomics that you wanted to get off your chest?
I like this book. Book good. Nice. As the great words of the great Coop would say, book good.
Oh, those are very wise words. Thank you.
Very wise.
Couldn't have said better myself. All right. That's Orconomics. And that was our SPFBO. You were about to do a... sorry.
I was about to say bye.
I totally... extended the credits. Yeah, you did. I made a big mistake, but I'm committed. SPFBO, this was our... second one we've done, because we didn't reread Sword of Kai again, but we'll be doing all 10 of the SPFBOs. If you look up the ones that have won in previous years, there's a wiki page about it you can very easily see. We'll actually have in the description below just the blog off link to where our placements are. Let us know in comment below if you made it to this point of ideas for Rich and I to determine when there's a tiebreaker. Of if, let's say, two books end up, because I gave this a 4-star, you gave this a 3.5. Average, that means, okay, it's a 3.75 if we combine our scores.
I have now changed my score to a 3.75.
So then average would be 3.82. Is that math correct? Whatever it would be. So whatever let's say we have two books that are both get that score. Mm-hmm. Let us know any creative ideas how to determine a tie. Nothing violent. Let us know something reasonable. Okay. Because we can talk afterwards for some ideas if it gets there, because we need to have the correct 10 in order so that the other people
know what to actually vote.
Exactly. So because Bookborn's also another judge, Philip Chase is another judge. We have to show by example what the correct order is.
That is true. I mean, that is the goal, is to ultimately we will submit our list and then the final breakdown list will just be our list.
If we do our job correctly.
If we do our job correctly, we will be objectively correct. And if the end result is different from our list, then we know that the competition is rigged and ultimately fraudulent because they didn't get it right.
Mark Lawrence is going to hate us. He picked the wrong people.
Mark, if you can't tell, joking. I hope.
Satire, yes.
Satire. But seriously, I think we're pretty great at judging things.
Also, very, I don't know if he said this entire video, but he said it off, but we're so honored to be a part of the contestants there.
Yeah, like that, cool.
I didn't emphasize this in spoilers. That was fucking awesome. Yeah. Being asked to judge stuff and going, we're going to review the books anyways, and we get to say, hey, this is what we, it's, oh.
Yeah.
Ah, cool.
I'm excited.
Very excited. Okay. Roll credits.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.